Yeah.
I don't think I deserve that many credits that you cited, but I really try to do my best to be involved in issues of medicine aloha. On the one hand, I do other things as well, but for the purpose of this meeting, and as Rabbi Weiner said, I had really a tremendous course that I feel my greatest course that I had the chance to be close to the Gdoyle Ador. Now we can say the previous door almost. From Zalman Neuerbach primarily, the Tzitzeliezer, Rav Eliashiv, Rav Vosner, Rav Yosef, really all the leaders of the halachic contemporary period. And much of what I know is that I know firsthand from what I heard from those Gdoyle Ador. There obviously are newer shailas that came up after they passed away, and life continues, and we have to continue and deal with new issues. So I thought that actually the best would be to open to shailas, and if I know the answer, I'll share with you answers. So that I think would be the major part of our meeting. But let me share with you something which is cooking now, something very new, that has halachic huge ramifications. The question is if it will be accepted by the current Gedoyle. And that is what is called the Jewish gene. And I'll explain a little bit about what it is and what the halachic basis of the discussion is. Every cell in the body has a nucleus which contains over 99% of the genetic material that we are composed of. And there are a few organelles within the cell that are called mitochondria that have separate around 30, 35 genes that are different from the major genes of the nucleus. And the job of the mitochondria is to supply the energy to the cell to do the work. So it is not something that contributes to any character of ours or to any disease or to any genetic significance of what we are, but it supplies the energy so that the cell can work. Now the egg is one of the largest cells in the body, and hence it contains quite a few mitochondria. The sperm is one of the smallest cells in the body, and it contains very few mitochondria. Something that really it's God's creation, we probably don't know even why. When the sperm and the cell unite, when fertilization occurs, there is a mechanism that destroys the few mitochondria that come from the sperm. So that all the mitochondria that we have, we inherit only from the mother. No contribution from the father at all. That obviously has a significance from a Jewish point of view related to whether we are Jewish or not, because Jewishness comes only from the mother. It has nothing to do with the father. Now these mitochondria, over generations, have some mutations, some changes that occur at some point, and they are quite stable. If it occurs once in 1,000 years ago, it will be transmitted the same change over the generations for many, many generations. And here and there may be an added mutation that will be added to the transmission to the next generation. So there is a field in genetics that is called genetics of societies, whereby looking at the differences in the mutations of the mitochondria, you can identify who belongs to whom. They did a lot of studies in Africa. There are all kinds of tribes, the Zulu, the Tutsi, the all kinds, I don't know their parts, but there are many tribes. And at some point they were mixed together and they were fighting each other. And they wanted to know who belongs to whom. So there is a mitochondrial change that is significant to the Zulu and another one to another tribe, and thereby you can distinguish who is who. Taking this idea, one of the scientists in Israel, by the name of Professor Skoretsky, a firm scientist in Haifa, developed a whole study to look into the mitochondrial mutations in Jews. And he looked in different sub-tribes, mainly Ashkenazi, but he looked also into Georgian Jews and Caucasian Jews and some other areas. And he found that there are unique changes in the mitochondria which occur in Jews and do not occur in the non-Jewish people surrounding them. So, for instance, in the Ashkenazi Jews, he found a certain type of mutation that is not found in any other of the neighboring nations where the Ashkenazi Jews are living in. Now, this may have a huge significance, particularly to the Russian Jewry. The Russian Jewry that for 70 years were under communism, they lost any evidence of them being Jews. There are no witnesses, there are no documents, there are no other signs, except for if someone comes and says, I know I'm Jewish, but can you prove you are Jewish? It's almost impossible. So the question is, if we will test the mitochondria of this gentleman or this woman who comes and claims they are Jewish and will find that they have the Jewish gene, can we decide that they are Jewish just by the genetic finding? Now, what is the halachic issue here? So the change in the mitochondria is a siman. It's a sign. Simonim, there are many sugyas in Shas dealing with simonim. Simonim Doraisa, Simonim Lav Doraisa, Simon Muvak, Simon Beinoni, Simon Garua, there are all kinds of sugyas. The major two sugyas that simonim are relevant is Eilu Metzias, right? You find a lost object, you have a sign on it. If it's a Simon Muvak, you have to give it back. If it's a Simon Beinoni Garua, you don't have to give back. And the other is the sugya of Aguna. You find a body of a missing person, and that happens to be a husband of a married woman. And he has a sign on his body that the woman claims, my husband had this type of a sign. So again, if it's a Simon Muvak, you allow her to get remarried. And if it's not a Simon Muvak, then you don't know if this is the husband's body. So interestingly, there are so many sugyas. There are Piskei Haloches, in Rif, in Rambam, in Tur, in Shulchan Aruch, talking about Siman Muvak, Siman Beinoni, Siman Garua, but no definition what constitutes a Siman Muvak. You find now a new Siman, and you ask yourself, is it a Siman Muvak or not? How do you judge it? If Chazal said that this and this is a Siman Muvak, that the way you tied the object is a Siman Muvak, or the way they were arranged, the Gemara that talks about certain circumstances. So the Gemara says, this is a Siman Muvak, so we know. But if something that wasn't mentioned in Shas, or wasn't mentioned in Rishonim, you find now a new Siman, how do you judge if it's Muvak or not? That's really interesting that all the generations, all the Rishonim and Shas included, didn't define it. They just gave examples. The first, I think, that tried to define it was the Masas Bin Yomi, who was a Talmud of the Remo. And he really asked the Shaila. They found it was an Aguna Shaila. They found a body. There was some kind of a Siman. Is it a Siman Muvak or not? Can he tell the woman to get married or not? So he claims that if it is one in a thousand or less, that makes it a Siman Muvak. So 1 promille of frequency is a Siman Muvak. Now, he doesn't have any source to it. It's just a svore. But it makes sense. It's rare enough that if you find a body that only one in a thousand have this type of a siman, or you find an object that only one in a thousand have this siman on the object, then it's a siman mubah. Now, at the moment, there are not thousands of cases that were studied on the mitochondria change, but calculating what was studied so far, the number of Jews that were studied, and by the way, to include someone in the Jewish study to look for his mitochondria, you need a definite proof that both sets of parents and grandparents have evidence that they were Jewish. So that we are really talking about a Jew, halachically speaking. And you test his mitochondria, and then you go to other people who are definitely not Jewish, and you test them, and you find that the here you find it, there you don't find it. It's not zero on the other side, and it's not 100% on this side. So the calculation at the moment is one in 950. So is it included in the Siman Muvak of one in a thousand or not? So I think obviously it does, because even the Masas Ben Yomi didn't mean really to count one in a thousand. He meant approximately one in a thousand. So one in 950 would not be something that we wouldn't accept. Moreover, we are testing it. We know it's one in 950 at the moment. Maybe there'll be larger numbers and it will be even less than one in a thousand. Or maybe it will turn out that it's only one in 500. Depends on. But statistically, it is significant. Whereas the Masas Ben Yomi didn't go out and looked for all the bodies around, for 1,000 bodies, and find this only in one body. He just estimated it's infrequent enough to say that it probably is one in 1,000. Now, if the Truma Sadation, for instance, added a new semen on the body, if there's a big lump on the nose, and if the woman says, my husband had a big lump on the nose, and you find a body with a big lump on the nose, then this is her husband, and she is muta. To say that a lump on the nose is so rare that no one else in the world has a lump on the nose is obviously not the case. It is rare enough. But to say that a mitochondrial change, that 20,000 non-Jewish people don't have it, and the Jews have it, that should be regarded as a siman muvah. There's another halachic question here on the definition of what do we look in a siman. So the most of the examples are that the siman is outside of the object and it verifies that this is the particular object that we talk of. Either it's the pearls that I lost or it's the body of this particular person. The mitochondrial change doesn't prove that whoever has the change is Pliny Almoyni. It only makes him included in a group that has this type of a change. Is this also regarded halachically in the framework of simonim? Is it a siman? So there are proofs from Shas to say yes, it is. I'll give you just one. The Gemara in Bava Basra on Rov VeKarov discusses a case where a baby chicken is going away from the owner, and if it goes up to 50 amma, it belongs to the one that had the shobach, and if it goes beyond 50 ammas, then it came from the world and it's not his. Now, what does it mean? If it would have been that he has black chickens, and this is a black one, and therefore you say it belongs to him, that is an external sign, the regular sign, that belongs to him. Here, the fact that it went up to 50 amma or more than 50 amma is a character of this part of the general chickens that don't go more than 50 ammas. So that doesn't make him belong to the owner. It means that he is part of a group that should belong to him because he went less than 50 amma. It's the same concept. So if indeed the Jewish gene will be regarded halachically as a siman muvak, then we can really help many Jews that can't identify themselves as Jewish in any other way, if it will be siman muvak. Now, it is never a negative siman. In other words, if we will test all of you here, and 20% of you don't have the Jewish mitochondrial change, doesn't mean you are not Jewish. Why? Because perhaps 10 generations before, someone converted. The Giyur is halachically including him as a Jew, but the Giyur didn't change the mitochondria. The mitochondria remained a Goyish mitochondria, right? Whatever he was then. And it will transmit the same way. But halachically, he is Jewish. So if someone has a chazoka that he is Jewish, he is Jewish, no matter if he has the mitochondrial change or he doesn't have. If, however, he doesn't know if he is Jewish, or we can't prove that he is Jewish, then we can include him positively if the mitochondrial change is comparable with what we call the Jewish gene. So that is now debated very heatedly in the Bat Dinim, at least in Israel. I don't know about the States. It comes here too.
Every few months, I get an application from someone saying their DNA testing shows that they have
the Jewish gene.
That's what they claim.
Okay, so now I think it's very important to do it correctly, and not every lab knows how to do it the right way. I'm not sure that every lab would even bother to invest in it because it really is meaningless, except for us. It doesn't mean anything for science or for the lab that does these things. So I don't know who does it and how they do it. But at least in the lab of Professor Skoretsky, there is a large body of comparable mitochondria that he can compare the changes and see if it belongs to this or to that. And it is, as I said, debatable. There was an interesting case of from family from the United States, that one of the sons left everything, decided he doesn't want to be from anymore. He went to Sweden, and he decided to marry a non-Jewish woman. As even stronger, getting away from Jewishness. So the family lost contact with him, except for one sister who felt it's still her brother, and she kept some contact, and at some point she went to visit him in Sweden, and she was dressed like from woman with the shaitel, long sleeves and so on. And when she knocked at the door and she came in, this non-Jewish woman looked at her and she said, "You know, you remind me about my grandmother who used to look like you." So the question is she really the granddaughter of a Jewish woman, and therefore she is Jewish, although she was raised as a non-Jewish, and he thought that he's doing a big thing, he's marrying a non-Jewish woman. So they agreed to do the testing, and her DNA proved to be Jewish. So now, is it just relying on the DNA, or can we even relate to it as raglaim ledovar, that what she said, Messiah lefituma, that that is something that will add to it? So I think that most Batadinim, at least in Israel now, regard this as a siman, but not as a siman muvak to rely on it only at the moment. But if there is something else that by itself you wouldn't include her as, or him as a Jew, and that they test positively in combination, that will be helpful and will be acceptable. So I think that is now what is cooking in Bat Dinim all over the world, I guess, but I'm coming from Israel and I'm telling you where it stands. By the way, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, that we presented the whole issue, agreed it's a siman muvak, and for him it is good enough to make someone Jewish based on that. But as I said, it's still a debatable issue.
Is it going to be worse for them or somebody?
What?
Is it going to be worse for them and find somebody who is really racist?
Anyway, so that's just a cute anecdote. So just something to tell you that is going on, but it's open for you if you want to raise an issue, and I can be helpful to answer.
But that decision is based solely on mitochondrial DNA. Some of them are coming to us with testing that they're claiming is general. I'm not sure that they're meeting the same scientific standard.
So that, I don't think, has ever been proven that it is a Simon Muvak. I mean, you can have changes that are maybe typical, but not Simon Muvak. So that probably will not be accepted.
Yeah, we have to accept.
Right. Okay?
The Kohanim DNA that they were saying,
okay.
Is that mitochondrial?
No. Mitochondria is only from the woman,
yeah,
and the Kohen has to come from the father. Yeah, so you need a change in the sperm to prove that you are the son of a Kohen, right? So it has to come from the male. There are a lot of shyness. First of all, scientifically, it is not as validated as the Jewish gene. And secondly, on Kohanim, we have chazokes. And to take science and take someone out of a chazoke, no one yet has agreed to do it. For instance, someone who has a chazoke is a Kohen, and he wants to marry a grusha. So he goes and tests his Y chromosome, and there isn't the Kohen gene. That doesn't mean that he's not a Kohen, not enough to take him out of the chazoke. And to put him into the chazoke, he wants to go up in Duchen, so he won't Duchen. That's not really something that is of a significant a change in what we do. But to make someone Jewish or not is significant. You could argue, why go into all this debate? If we have a Sofek, if he's Jew or not, let's Megayer him. And you don't need to look for anything else. But Giyur is a problem. If it's a female, then she can't marry Koy. If it's a family that doesn't keep Torah mitzvahs, you probably won't even contemplate to Megayer him. But maybe he is Jewish. Maybe he doesn't need a Giyur. So if you can prove it, that really has a significance. That's why that is a more of an issue than the Kohen gene.
What's the confidence of the, like you said, you might have mentioned it, they did tests of other tribes and there was zero?
No, zero. So the numbers now that I know of, but it changed because they're all the time adding numbers, I think they tested around 2,000 Ashkenazi Jews and 20,000 non-Jews in the same areas. And they found 40% of the typical mitochondrial change of a Jewish Ashkenazi Jew. And they found two cases, not 2%, two cases in the 20,000 who have the same change, which probably these two are Jewish. They just don't know. Because two out of 20,000, it's not even a statistical error. It's just a case. So I think it has a power from a statistical point of view. I don't want to go into the whole debate, does statistics play a role in halacha? It's very complicated because we usually go by simple rules, not by statistical rule. For instance, rov behemos ksheiros. What does it mean? That someone went all over the world, in all the generations, tested all the behemoths, and found that robot shares. That doesn't happen. Chazal didn't even test the robot behemoths in their area compared to the non and made a statistical analysis if it's a significant change or not. If it's a robot, it's a robot. And Shlomo Zalman brings a riot that we don't go over statistics. If you have six stores selling kosher meat and four selling non-kosher meat, and you found outside a piece of meat, it's kosher, right? Because you go by rov and call the Polish meruba Polish. It's not a kavua. But if you find 10 pieces and you take each piece and you ask, is it kosher or not? On each piece separately, you will say yes, because each piece Polish Meluba. But statistically, it doesn't make sense. Can't be that all 10 came only from the 6 kosher ones and not from the 4. So you go by a simple law, case by case. So statistics probably doesn't play a major role in halacha.
What is the status now of genetic testing for other areas? DNA Momenes, Montserrat's, do we have the same kind of...
Right. So there we are testing not the mitochondria, we are testing the DNA. And here we know for a fact that DNA is very, very unique to each individual. If we spoke about 1 in 1,000, here we speak maybe 1 in 30 million, that the same DNA can occur twice. So from my understanding, DNA is a siman muvak by every criteria, even before the Masos Binyomi. That's a clear-cut siman. So where can you use it? So you can use it, for instance, when unfortunately there is a terrorist attack and many bodies are injured and you find here a hand and there a leg and you want to bury one person. So you do a DNA testing on the hand compared to the body and on the leg compared to the body, and you can accumulate those who are this person, and you can bury them as one person. Everyone agrees that that is reliable. Why not? The other issue is aguna. If you find a part of a body and you take the DNA from this part and you compare it to the DNA of his hair in his hairbrush left at home, and it's identical. So this is the person. How can you say differently? I mean, there are people who say differently, but I'm saying from what we understand on Rov, on Siman Muvak, that's a Siman Muvak. For instance, a divorce case, and there's a child, and the father has to pay mezoinis. And he says, that's not my child. Why should I pay mezoinis? So how would we know if he is the father of the child or not? So if you do a DNA testing, you can find out for sure if this is his child or not. So if you find that he is not his child, then you can't make him pay mezoinis. The problem here will be that if he is not his child and his wife is an Eshes Ish, so the child is a mamzer. Do we rely on the DNA not only to exempt him from paying mezoinis, but also to make the child a mamzer? So most Bate Dinim in Israel, at least, some of them don't even want to test it. They say, let him pay, but we don't want to make a mamzer. But most Bate Dinim make sort of palgina ledibua. They say, 4 dinim mamonos, it's good enough. But to make him a mamzer, it's not good enough. So scientifically speaking, it doesn't make sense. If it's good for this, it's good for that, and vice versa.
Why can't you say Nisabra Bambatia?
No, but you can say Nisabra Bambatia doesn't happen. I mean, Chazal talked about it, and Ben Sira was the son of Yeremiah from his daughter, and apparently it happened. But it doesn't happen today, so I don't know what if there's a change in nature or whatever, but it can't happen. Scientifically, it can't happen. But maybe she had an affair with an non-Jew. So then the child isn't a mamzer. That's one way. The other way out is to say that for mamzerus, you need edus. It's not because the DNA is not neman, but because dovar shebeerva, you need shnei edim. And if there are no shnei edim, then even though in metzias he's a mamzer, halachically.
Huh?
Well, but if you have a proof, a full proof, then it's like Eidim. I mean, Eidim is not Zeras HaKosov on Dinei Mamonos. It's just a Biru. And if you can do a Biru differently, then it should be okay. So that is what most Bote Dinim do with it. So that is DNA. I think DNA is even a better proof halachically than the mitochondrial change, because the mitochondrial change, A, it's new and we don't know yet where it will lead, and maybe with many more testings it will turn out that it's not so unique. And B, it is only related to whether you are Jewish or not. It doesn't have any other ramifications. Whereas DNA has many, many ramifications.
DNA of a relative, not necessarily the same person, but matching to a relative.
Right.
That also, that same...
Right, so that's a son and a father.
No, it could be like a cousin has similar, you know, if you don't have their DNA, but you want to get some relative's DNA.
So it will be close, but not identical. Mm-hmm. The more it is closer to the person himself, is the better proof it is.
Is that enough of a viewer?
So for Dina Momonos, yes. But if he went through this, you have a cousin and you want to be Mater and Aguna, that would be a problem. Yes.
I'm sorry for bringing this up, but the policy implications of these decisions in Israel are very profound, particularly with the Russian Jews and coming in and their status in the state. What are the implications more broadly? And if there was an anti-Semite who wanted to say, now we found the Jewish gene, what are the potential implications of this policy shift or this policy understanding on a broader basis?
I don't think anti-Semites need genetic proof. They were before we knew genetics, and they'll be probably after that. I don't think that will make any... I mean, yes, you can identify that he's Jewish, but whether you hate him or not has nothing to do with the genetic change. By the way, there are anti-Semites that claim that we are actually not the Jews of antiquity. We are the descendants of the Khuzaris. And actually, we are goyim, like all the goyim, coming from the Khuzars. There was a study done of this type of DNA. I don't know exactly scientifically how it was done. And it was proven that we are not descendants of the Khuzars, not of this area of the world. So that by itself already helps against one claim of anti-Semitism. So that's one fallout of what we do. Yes. Right.
To rule in something, that becomes a little bit more difficult. When they say it's a 98% chance, 98% match. So that means, there is a chance that it's not.
Right. So
how does that? I remember.
Yeah. So you really infer to the times before DNA, when we tried before the DNA to find scientifically if he is or isn't the child of this particular father, we use, for instance, blood grouping. And if you are an A and the child is an O, he can't be your child. But if you are an A and he is an A, it is not necessarily that he is your child, because there are many people who have A, right? So then that was used only to exclude and not to include. That is not the case with DNA. DNA is almost 100% as 100% can be.
He's the father's child.
Yes, because only these two people, only a father and a child, can have this particular match of the DNA. Mm-hmm. If it is a different child, he will have a different match. And therefore, it is inclusive and exclusive.
Well, when they say the DNA is 95% natural,
it's not 95. It's close to 100. As close... What?
In the criminal cases, the news report, I don't know, I'm not a mutter, but they say that the DNA was a 95%.
No, it's much, much higher than 95%. Even in criminal cases. By the way, that's another issue, halachically to speak. Let's say Sanhedrin comes up now, and there is a rapist or there is a murderer, and you find a drop of blood, and you take the DNA from this drop of blood, and you compare to the person that you accuse as the murderer, and it is 100 or 99.99% that this is the person. Would you execute him halachically? The answer probably is no, for the same reason, because you need aiding. So it's not that we don't believe science that indeed he is the murderer, but by halachic criteria, capital punishment is done only by Edim and by Tzroah. So let's say you find it, the blood wasn't matre, didn't give a Hatroah to the person, don't kill, right? So if they're missing Hatroah and they're missing Edim, then by halachic criteria, you won't be able to execute this murderer or rapist or whatever. But not because scientifically he's not the right person. That probably is as close as 100% can be. By the way, Edim are less reliable than DNA, if you think about it. Because Edim can lie. It's true that you do drisha v'chakira and you look and you ask and so on, but after all that, Edim can lie. And it's not 100% proof ever. It's a gzeiras hakosuf, that is how you rule. But we don't have a gzeiras hakosuf on DNA.
I think if I could restate the question, in court cases generally, DNA evidence is always brought into question, and it has to do with the procedures, it has to do with how it's collected, it has to do with the lab is good, the lab wasn't good, did they do it the proper way, and how do you...
So in rabbinic court, for instance, case of fatherhood, they always request two independent labs that will do the same testing, not knowing each of the other. So that's an issue of mnemonos. I'm talking about the science.
Yeah, yeah.
The science is clear. Now, whether the evidence is clear, there are always questions. Maybe they didn't use the right material. Maybe they are not experts enough. Maybe they have some bias to do it, so and so on. So these are questions of mnemonos of the person performing it.
But the person has to do that too.
So the person has to do it, and usually they ask for two independent, separate labs to do the same testing. And if it comes from both and they don't know each other, then it's a sign of mnemonics.
One of the things we're seeing more and more are egg donors. And while most, at least in our community, of the people receiving an egg donor are trying to get it from a certified Jewish donor, there are clearly, even within our religious community, those who are taking a over from a non-Jewish mother. Would that change the equation here? And I think many of the Rabbanim don't realize how common it is, because you never know, the child is born naturally, but in the Beis Din we know it's happening often.
So there are two issues. One is, what do you do with a child born in this way? What is his status? And I assume you refer to the next question, the DNA, the mitochondria will come from a different woman, and this woman may be a not Jewish woman. Presumably, the DNA testing will show that she's not Jewish, or at least that she doesn't have the Jewish gene. That will be clear. I mean, if the egg comes from the pool of non-Jewish women, then it didn't undergo the mutation of the Jewish gene. So that would be easy. Now, what do you do with an egg donor who is Jewish versus an egg donor who is not Jewish would depend on how you define motherhood, which is a big machloikes. And there are at least four opinions. Now we have even an option of a third mother, including the mitochondria. I don't know if you are aware of it. Maybe I'll say a few words of it, because it will become something that will be done. But at the moment, we may have a mother that is the genetic mother. So if an ovum is donated, then the real mother is the owner of the ovum and not the mother who delivered the child. That is one shita. The other shita said the opposite. I don't care where the genetic material comes, I care who was pregnant and who delivered, and that is the mother. A third option is that neither is the mother, because in order to be a mother, you have to have one woman do both acts. And the fourth option is that both are the mother. And that is now, at least in Israel, the prevailing psak, based on Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Eliashiv, who didn't speak to each other about it, but they came to almost the same conclusion, which means that we really can't solve the question, who is the mother, when you separate the two functions of motherhood. And because we can't come to a conclusion, then lechumra, we have to regard both of the mothers. What does it mean, lechumra? So that if either of the women is not Jewish, the child will need the gear lechumra. none of the children will be able to inherit either of the mothers, because amoytzi mechaver or lavaraya, and since it's a sofek, if this is your mother and this, kibud em, he'll need to have for both. I mean, everything that you can think about a mother, you take the chumra on both. That is the shit of Shlomo Zalman. Incident?
Marrying
a koyen, it's after giyur.
Yeah, yeah.
If you do giyur, but yeah. We'll come to it in a minute. But before coming to just the status. So, Shlomo Zalman apparently at some point held that the egg donor is the mother. And it was published in his name that this is a shita. I discussed it with him much later, and he told me that he had some notion that this is true, but when he went over all the sources that everyone brings, one side or the other, he rejected all of them. And he said, and I think only Shlomo Zalman can say such a thing, that not only don't I know who is the mother, but no one will know it until Mashiach will come. We can't solve this problem. And it's not unusual. Shas is full of teiku, that even Tanoim and Amoim didn't know the final answer, and Tishbi Yitaret. So we don't know. That's not unusual. But not knowing isn't helpful to solve a case by case. So therefore he said, we have to go to Chumra on both sides. With Rabbi Eliashib, Shlomo Zalman, when whoever asked him explained why he says so and what I saw says, and you understood what he says and why. With Rabbi Eliashib, you ask a shayla, he says also mutar, and that's it. And now you have to figure out what he meant and why he meant and what was important in the shayla that made him think one way or the other. I had a lot of experiences of this kind that I said one thing and someone else said in his name the opposite. And it turned out that the way we posed the question was a little bit different, that for us didn't make any difference. But for him, it was a major difference, and the psak came out on the other side. So anyway, the story is, it's not a story, I mean, the facts are that someone came to him and said an egg donor was non-Jewish, the child is born, what should we do with the child? He says, Chayav Giyu. So he came out and said, Rabbi Eliashib holds that the egg donor is the mother, and therefore, Chayav Giyur, that makes sense. Another one came to him and said, the surrogate mother was a non-Jewish woman. What do we do? He says, Chayav Giyur. So he published in the name of Rabbi Eliashib that the giving birth mother is the mother and not the egg donor. So Rav Sherman, who was one of the Dayonim in Beis Din Hagadol, was very close to him, came to him and said, Rebbe, what do you say? Is this the mother of this? What do you say? So he said, I hold both are mothers l'chumra. Therefore, in both cases, you need gil. So that probably was his shita as well. And now, most but the dinim, at least in Israel, regard it that way. But now think about the practicality of it. Let's say a boy is born, and he needs gil. When would you do the gil? At the bris, what brocha would you make if he's a sofer giyur? If he's a Jew, you say alamila, and you say lachniso bebris shel Avraham Avinu. If it's l'shem giyur, you say lamul esagerim, and no lachniso bebris shel Avraham Avinu. So what do you say? Yeah, but okay. So you write that lachniso you shouldn't say because sofer brochas lehok. But which brocha do you say? One brocha, it's either alamila or lamula sager. So Zal Nechem Yepaskin to say alamila, because some hold that even for giyur, alamila is the right brocha, and even if not, it's a generic brocha. Whereas lamula tagerim is only if you know that he's a goy, and if he's not, it's a brocha levator. But he added something which I think shows some sensitivity. He says, you come to a place of such a child. Obviously, the parents don't want anyone to know that he is a product of an egg donor or a surrogate mother, right? They want a regular bris. So if you'll come and you'll say alamila, fine. But you won't say lachniso, everyone will shushke, well, what happened here? Why don't you say the brocha? So he said, tell the moil, or the father to say alamila, And then, so some people will think that he made the broche without Shemu Malchus, and no one will talk about it. Anyway, no one is listening carefully to every word of the broche, so that way you get out of it. That was it. Now, if it's a female, and she gets a giyur lechumra, so apparently she should be also lekoyim. So Reb Osher Weiss has an interesting psak on it, saying that since it's a big chumra to do the giyur, and actually she probably doesn't need the giyur, so in this case she will be mutar lekoyim. It's a big chiddush, but
what about her contra? He only says that about her contra replacement therapy, not for any.
No. For either egg or surrogacy, yeah. That a female is born. Then she's not also lekoyim, because it's not a real giyur. It's not a giyur l'shem giyur, it's a giyur l'shem chumra. Okay, he has a whole mahalach. I don't know if everyone agrees. Now, about the mitochondria, there is a group of serious diseases that are caused due to changes in the mitochondria. It's not the mutation that I was speaking before that have no significance. It just happened and it doesn't do anything wrong. But for us, it may be a sign. But there are changes in the mitochondria that create significant diseases. So today, there is a treatment to it. And the treatment is as follows. You take the egg of the woman that wants a child, but her mitochondria are sick. You take out the nucleus from her egg. You take another egg from another woman that her mitochondria are healthy. You take out her nucleus and you implant in her egg with the healthy mitochondria the nucleus from the woman that her mitochondria are sick. And now you have a new egg that has 99% of the genetic material of the woman that wants the child. And together with it, the child has mitochondria from a different woman, but they are healthy. Now, is the... And then implant this new combination into the woman, and a child is born. So, who is his mother now? Is it only dependent on the nucleus, or is it also dependent on the mitochondria? If it's dependent on also on the mitochondria, so he has two mothers. And if it will be implanted in a surrogate woman, then you get a third mother. So is the mitochondria adding a mother? So on that, Reb Osher Weiss paskin that not, but we can argue about his reasoning. He said that the mitochondria, as I said, has only 27 or 37 genes altogether, compared to 25,000 that are in the nucleus. So it's a small mute. And the mute is bottle. So therefore, we don't regard the mother. But if we go according to this, it's a davar mamid. You can't live without the mitochondria. So davar mamid isn't bottle. So I don't think that you can go in hilchos taroivos here. It's not an issue of hilchos taroivos. In my opinion, and I'm just giving an idea, The mitochondria, as I said, has only one function, to give energy to the cell. It doesn't add anything to the person as such. And to be a parent, parenthood is someone who gives 50% of what the person is. And the mitochondria don't do anything. It's true that without the mitochondria, there's no life. But without a heart, there's also no life. And if you'll take a heart from someone and implant, it doesn't become your parents. Although you need it. You can't survive without it. So the mitochondria is not the same DNA, the same genetic material that has a parenthood in it. It has a function. So therefore, I think the fact that it's given from someone else, it's like you implanted a heart or a kidney, which are necessary. Without it, there's no life. And there are all kinds of diseases of the heart and the kidney. And yet, it doesn't make you a parent if you donated a heart or a kidney. I think that is the same analogy, and therefore, it is not an added mother. But that is an idea. I mean, you can think about it.
the situation where the woman received an egg donor, but then she was told it was Jewish, and it's, but it wasn't the certification. So just being to rely on, to use that the test.
Right.
To use that test that the Rav mentioned.
Right. Absolutely.
That would be yeah. accepted. That would be
absolutely. We do the same thing even much more frequently with sperm donation. At least in Israel, I don't know here, but in Israel, a sperm donor is anonymous. And now you have a boy and a girl coming, and let's say even we know that both came from sperm donors. Maybe they come from the same father. That's called Shema Yisra Aches Achoiso, right? And their children will be Mamzeri. So how do you know that these two are not the products of the same sperm donor? So we do a DNA testing on both. And if they are comparable, then we know that they have a mutual father. And if not, we know they don't have a mutual father. But even if you take a egg donor or a surrogate knowingly that it's Jewish, that the woman is Jewish, that may create a new problem. And this is that if she gets lost, let's say she donated an egg and she gets lost, who cares anymore? She may donate an egg to another person, and then there is the chashash ma'isach esachoisim. So we are in Israel very makpid to know who the donor is, to have it registered, so that if the child comes to get married, we can verify that it's not the half brother, half sister. At least lechumra, because she is the mother, as we said, lechumra. So that is very important to know, because in many countries, okay, she donated, she disappears, she got her money, and she goes away. That will create, that may create a problem. Did that what?
If the husband or the mother or the father has some type of mental disease, or they have some type of disease, is it genetic or not? And how far do you go? With brothers, sisters, or uncles? That's a very relevant question.
Right. Right. But the answer is each case on its own merits. I mean, there are diseases that we know the genetic transmission. There are diseases we don't know the genetic transmissions. And there are diseases that we know that they are not genetic. So the fact that, what?
Like what, for example, are those that are not genetic?
All kinds of behavioral problems that people have are not necessarily genetic. And some types of epilepsies are not necessarily genetic. So you have to look into each case, see through the doctors what subtype of the illness it is, and what is known about the genetics of it. Now, some are recessive, which means that only 25% of the children will be sick, provided the spouse has the same problem. If it doesn't have the same problem, there'll be no problem at all to the children. If it's dominant, then 50% of the children will have the disease, no matter who the spouse is. So these are all issues that you have to ask the doctor who understands in these issues what is known about it. And by the way, while we are speaking, I'm sure there's a new genetic disease discovered, and you need to be updated all the time. I'm asked many times about all kinds of diseases. Many of them, I just don't know. I have to look up. It's impossible to know all diseases, but there are facts. It's not just to say, because he's sick, so don't marry him because all the children will be sick. That's not true.
What about deep depression? Deep depression. How about that deep depression? Is it genetic or not?
So again, there are depressions that are called endogenous, that are sometimes genetic, and there are depressions that are exogenic, that came from circumstances, from life events, they are not genetic.
What about cancer?
Many cancers, I won't say most, but many cancers are not genetically determined. But there are who are, yeah. So again, I'm saying you have to ask exactly what cancer you talk about and what is known about this cancer, genetically speaking. I'll tell you a story now that we are in the midst of a very problematic situation. There is a gene, it's called Leframeni, doesn't matter the name. It's quite rare, that causes multiple types of cancers in the same person, unrelated. Not metastases, just different cancers. Can be a cancer of the thyroid, of the kidney, of the lung. It comes and goes or doesn't go, but there are many cancers. So it's a very serious genetic disorder. If you know that the person is carrying this gene, you can follow him carefully with total body MRI once a year and all kinds of testings, and try to identify the first signs of a cancer and treat it. Then it's treatable. So you found the first sign of a thyroid cancer, you treated it, he is clear. In 3 years, you find the first signs of a kidney cancer, you treat him, he's clear. So it's very important to know who is a carrier. It is also important to know, because today we can do a procedure which is called PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and we can avoid the birth of the next generation with this gene. We can eliminate this gene. So if we know that a person is carrying this gene, A, we can save his life, and B, we can advise him to go through PGD and make sure that his children don't inherit this particular gene. So here comes a young lady in her 30s with metastatic breast cancer already very advanced. And by taking history, it turns out that when she was a child, she had a thyroid cancer. When she was 20 years old, she had adrenal cancer. And someone put it together and tested for the gene, and indeed, she's carrying this gene. She is one of 10 children, and her parents, each of them, have 5 siblings each, and the 5 siblings have each of them between 5 and 10 children. So it's a huge tribe. So we told this girl, this woman, bring your parents, we'll test them, and if none of them is a carrier, then you are a new mutation and all the rest are fine, and forget about it. But if one or both parents have this gene, then we have to test the whole family and save their lives and prevent the next step, right? It makes sense. So she brought the parents, they were tested, and the father was found positive. At the time, he was healthy. In the meantime, he got cancer. So we told the parents, bring all your children and bring all your siblings and we'll test them. They refused. Why? For shidduchim purposes. They were afraid that if the world will know that in this family there is such a gene, no one will be able to be married, or many of them, and they were all in shidduchim already, and they refused. We tried to enforce it on them, we tried to threaten them, they don't want. What do you do in such a situation? On the one hand, you can save the lives of many. I'm not saying all of them are carriers, but many are. And on the and you can prevent the next generation from suffering. On the other hand, are you allowed to breach the confidentiality that the father is my patient and he doesn't let me tell someone else? Am I allowed to tell or not? So certainly from a halachic point of view, I'm mechuyev to do it. Because as the Chofetz Chaim says, if there is a danger to someone else uninvolved and you tell me not to tell, there's no isur echil, there's no isur lashonor, you are allowed or even obligated to save someone, and he gives examples which are minor compared to this situation. One of his examples is, if you have a maid at home and she stole and you fired her, and the next week you hear that your neighbor is hiring her, you are mechuyev to tell the neighbor that she stole. She should know. So if for that you are mechuyev to disclose, so here to save life, I think it's certain. But what do you do legally? Can you do it legally? So in Israel there's a law that on genetic diseases, not on regular diseases, regular diseases, there's a different law, but in genetic diseases, if a carrier of a serious genetic disease refuses to tell his family, you are allowed, that the healthcare provider of this patient is allowed to contact the physician of the family to tell him that there is someone who has a serious genetic disease, and he should disclose it to his patients. Now, the logic behind it is, I think, that I, as a geneticist, let's say, I don't know the family. I don't know how to talk to them even. I don't know how they will take it. But a family physician who is involved with the family, he'll probably do it better. But in our case, we don't even know the names of the siblings. How will we find 10 physicians of 10 children and another 15 physicians of siblings? It's just impossible. There's no way to do it. So how do you get out of it? You let them die or you do something. So at the moment, we are probably going to the court and tell the court that they should disclose the information or at least give us permission to go to the central registry and find out who they are, and the Kupot Cholim should let us know who their physicians are, and it's a major work, but I think we have to do it. I don't see any other way. But that is...
The father didn't get cancer until after his father.
Right. And even now, after he got the cancer...
And
Solomon
and I, he had a problem.
Okay.
That's all the
time Right. No, but the Moshe says that if it is something that you... The Moshe says if it's something that you can detect, it is like you would say, I'll put the blindfold there and I'll let you cross the street. Kadosh Baruch Hu will help. If Kadosh Baruch Hu wants you to cross safely, you'll cross safely. And if not, not. No one will do it. I mean, if you know how to treat something or to prevent something, you can't say...
This is very, very common with a BRCA.
Right. Yeah. Right. So the BRCA is a little bit different for several reasons. One is that not everyone who carries the BRCA gene will develop cancer. Today they talk about 80%, but maybe it's even a little less. What?
Right.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying not to, but I'm saying there are some differences. Secondly, a woman that knows that in her family there are people who had it, even if she doesn't test for it, she's more careful. She'll go to more mammographies, she'll go to more ultrasounds, she'll be careful. So she doesn't want to know the name, but she'll do it. But here, they don't even know to go to test, because they think the sister has cancer, so what? So we are free of it. That's a major difference.
That doesn't
move
the gentleman who is your patient?
I can't...
That doesn't move the gentleman who is your patient, that his family will suffer as a result? He's been told that...
Yeah, he has been told... Initially, in a nice way, you know that some may have cancer, it's dangerous. Later we said it, some of the children will die. You're causing them to die. It didn't move us.
Obviously, if he had HIV, if he had an infectious disease, that would be the loss would be different.
Right. So I'll tell you an Israeli chokhmah about that. The law in Israel says you're not allowed to disclose to others whatever is confidentially told to you by patients, but if it may cause an infection, an epidemic, then you're allowed to disclose to the surroundings and do the epidemiological testings in order to prevent the spread of the disease. So the principle, everyone understands, and I think everyone, if not everyone, certainly most of the people would agree that this is the right ethical approach. But the law specified which infectious diseases come within this law. Measles, rubella, and all kinds of such diseases. If one is diagnosed with measles, then you're allowed to do an epidemiologic search and to discuss, to tell everyone about it. When this list was done, AIDS wasn't in the world. So when AIDS came, there was a case of a man who had AIDS. He was married. And he said, I don't allow you to tell my wife. So they said, but you're endangering her. And according to the law, if you endanger by an infectious disease, you're allowed to say. He said, no, but it's not on the list. If it's not on the list, you can't do it. And at the time, there was no way to persuade him, and the woman contracted AIDS. So the Knesset made a change in the law, and they added AIDS. So when I came to discussions, I said, today you add AIDS. Tomorrow there will be another disease. We can't really know what it will be. Omit the whole list and say a general rule. Say when it is an infectious, serious disease, no matter what name it has, whatever is discovered, you're allowed to do it. That's the principle. Why go into details? But that's how the law is. So if there's a SIRS or something else new coming up, it's not included. Really typical. Yes. Right. So there are different approaches. I'm not voicing for myself, certainly not for America, but there are different approaches. Some say you want to be a physician, you have an achrayus, you have the obligation to be the best physician possible. And therefore you have to go to a program that will train you to be the best physician, unrelated if it's a Shomer Shabbos program. That's one approach. Another approach says Shabbos is more important, and with time you'll learn, even if you go to a less prestigious program, you will do your studies, and finally you'll be a good doctor as well, and you keep Shabbos the right way. Personally, I think it's very individual. I think it depends on the program, it depends on the person, it depends on what your aspirations are. I don't know that you can give such a general critical rule. And as you say, sometimes you apply to something, but you are shifted to something else, not even willing to do. To me, the only way to get around it is to have a non-Jew going with you on rounds on Shabbos. That's how we do in Shabbat Tzedek, and I think you can do it. I did it here when I trained in New York. It is not official, and I think officially it's even not allowed. But what I did personally, I took a fourth year Chinese student and I told them, come on Shabbos with me and tell your teachers that you are so studious, you come even on Shabbos and you make rounds and you want to know even more. And he did for me what I thought I can't do. And he was trained already, he was a sub-intern, so he understood more than just a regular non-Jew. And that's, I think, the only way to get around. Because to be makpid on Shabbos when you are, A, not always knowledgeable enough, what is an Issur D'oraisa, what is an Issur D'rabbanan, and how do you turn an Issur D'oraisa into an Issur D'rabbanan, you need to learn a lot to know it, and not always can you do it. And not always are the circumstances simple enough for you to do these changes. So if you have someone that... he can drive you, he can drive you back, he can put on the lights, he can put on the ophthalmoscope, the otoscope. You don't need an MD to do these acts. It doesn't disturb the care of the patient at all. And in this way, there's no limitation. You can do it everywhere.
It's pretty rare to have
it's rare to do it.
To be able to have such a, someone that's there to help you.
Yeah, you pay him. Why not?
That's not what you meant.
What?
Oh, you paid him?
You paid him? Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. That was a very nice guy. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Now, if you find a nice guy that really wants to study Matel, yeah.
If you test him genetically?
This may not apply or be able to be applied to someone pursuing a surgical route.
Well, in surgery, many of the acts that you do to the patient are at least sofer pikuach nefesh, so you're allowed to do it. And nowadays, you're allowed to do it even for non-Jews, but mishum eva,
all poskim agree that nowadays you shouldn't distinguish. But even there, if you take history, you don't have to write every word that he says, where exactly he lives and what his grandmother had, and all these details, you don't have to write. That's an issue device.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Steinberg. I think Dr. Steinberg's assistant, Vinny, is going to just say a couple words. Then I have parking validations. If anyone wants to have a mincha, we're going to make a mincha minion also in here. Just a moment.
Okay, shalom to all of you. I would like to inform.